So what I want to do is talk about for a while the emergence of of a way of talking about the power struggle that is a modification of what we used to do. I started to say new, it is relatively new, it certainly is a modification. And I want to talk about the power struggle in terms of what appears to me to be finally figuring out what is really going on in the power struggle, and moving away from just a description of the interactions of the power struggle to an awareness of what produces those interactions, sort of like underneath the phenomena, what is really going on. So I'd like to introduce that as the, and hopefully that my machine works, there we go, that the core in the power struggle is emotional symbiosis. And so I want to talk a little bit about what emotional symbiosis is. So where does emotional symbiosis come from? The thesis that I'm operating out of is a thesis that goes somewhat counter to, up until recently, traditional developmental theories. The genre of understanding that I was bred on and also taught for a number of years was that when children are born, that they are symbiotic. Meaning that when a child is born, it comes into the world and is basically fused with the mother, fused with the caretaker, and in fact cannot distinguish between itself and its self boundaries and the parent when it's born. And that symbiosis lasts for an indefinite number of months, a long period of time. In fact, it's interesting that in the studies by the Gassell Institute in the 1920s and 30s, it was pretty much considered that babies had no subjectivity until they were 18 months old. So that if you left them, if you punctured them, if you abused them, if you let them cry, not much was happening because there was no subjectivity anyway. It was just a kind of a neurophysiological mass that was reacting to stimuli. Then later, after that, there emerged the idea that the infant did in fact have a subjectivity, but the subjectivity was fused with the caretaker, and that the problem of human development was the differentiation of the infant from the caretaker, or the ending through the developmental growth of the symbiotic fusion. And that if people, and that not everybody did that, as people grew up, if they never went through that differentiation process, they would always grow up and have some sort of a sense of fusion with authority as replacements for the caretaker. And that was an operating fact. As I first put together my own developmental work, I was operating out of Margaret Mahler, in which that is one of the fundamental positions about the function of symbiosis. Now, I'd like to say that that particular position was undermined for me when my now 11-year-old daughter was born 11 years ago, who had a non-drug 3-hour birth process. I helped deliver her, held her in my hands first, did not spank her bottom, would not let the doctor injure her in any way, took her out, held her with the umbilical cord, put her on Helen's breast, and we kept our hands on her and relating to her for the first hour or so of her birth. I pick her up after this, and I'm holding her, and I'm looking at her, and she makes eye contact with me, holds eye contact, smiles, and relates to me as if we're separate people. And I look at Helen and I say, you can't do this. Babies can't do this until they're 8 months old, according to the literature. So we have a prodigy here. This is a child who has escaped the human process and emerged full-blown into the world as a self. And, you know, you just look at that and you say, well, now all my training says that what I am seeing cannot happen, so therefore it's not happening, and that there is a symbiosis which she will have to grow out of. But it was clearly the case that Leah was not symbiotic when she was born. So I began thinking about, well, what is the difference between Leah and, say, my other child who was born some years earlier? And the difference was that Leah was not drugged because Helen had no drugs. Leah had no injury because the birth went just like that. There was no obstruction whatsoever. She was born into a body temperature room and was immediately, after she was held a little bit, clearly washed, not in hot water, not in cool water, but in body temperature water. So there was no rupture of her experience of being in the womb. Leah is probably the most plugged in person into the world that I've ever seen. She has an enormous sense, without having training her, saying, think or look or be aware. She has a real sense of her context. Now, Hunter was born 2 years later by cesarean. He got turned crosswise. We had to go in and, what do you say, cut him out. He was traumatized. When he was handed to me, it was as though there was nobody in the world but him. And for the first, sometimes I still think that's the case, but for the first 5 or 6 years of his life, I thought he was autistic. I keep banging on him, and every time I got his attention, he was very much there. But he was very self-absorbed and very inward and very connected. He's slowly growing out of that. Well, he had drugs, he had injury, he had a lot of pain. He cried incessantly for the first 3 hours because of the amount of pain that he was in. So he experienced a normal birth, in the sense that it was normal births that were not cesarean have been that painful for babies who have been put through that injury. And we have had to work Hunter out of assuming that everybody was in his world functioning as he was, and that we were out. I keep saying to him, Hunter, I'm out here. And sometimes he opens his eyes and says, oh. And it's like, okay, now I see you're out there, but up until then, you didn't even exist. There was a real symbiotic thing with him. So as you now know, if you've been keeping up with this literature, the concept of the infant symbiosis with the caretaker, with the parent, is no longer a dominant piece of the literature. In fact, what we're now finding is in the literature is that infants are proto-empathic at birth, meaning that they show at birth behaviors that indicate that they are, in fact, relating to the caretaker's subjectivity and not simply experiencing those the fusion of those subjectivities. There are not only proto, but there's another word, I don't now remember it, but it's not yet true empathy at the age of 3 months. And now the literature is saying that by the age of 8 months, that infants who have been related to appropriately, that is, not injured, held, and so forth, are exhibiting true empathic responses to the caretaker, an impossibility in preceding literatures. So the question then is, how is it that most of us are symbiotic? Although babies are not by nature symbiotic with the caretaker. How is it that most of us are symbiotic? And the point that I'd like to make is that most of us are symbiotic, if not by nature, nevertheless, we are symbiotic. And I think the answer to that question is that emotional symbiosis, that is the fusion of our limited awareness of the inner world of others, of the ability to know that that's there, to relate to that, and to respect it, arises not out of our nature, but out of our woundedness. So that when we experience symbiosis in others, that is, when we experience other people generally assuming that we think, let me get this straight. When we experience other people generally assuming that they know what we know, think what we think, feel what we feel, and then what we're doing is really what they know and what they feel and what they think. When you experience this, which is a common human phenomenon, are you all familiar with this, what I'm talking about as a phenomenon? You are familiar with it. Okay. Just wanted to be sure about that. It's sort of like giving a lecture on romantic love to people who've never fallen in love. It's best to check and see, have any of you here ever fallen in love? So have any of you here ever experienced a symbiotic transaction with another person? And were you the originator or the receiver of that transaction? Let's see, how many of you were the receivers of the transaction? Symbiotic transaction. You were the receivers. And how many of you were senders of the transaction, of the symbiotic transaction? This is a pretty honest crowd. Some honesty here about that. I in fact have, as I've become more and more conscious of this phenomenon, have grown to love it. To be consciously symbiotic is a lot of fun. No, it's much more fun than being unconsciously symbiotic, because when you're unconsciously symbiotic, then when people differentiate in your face, you think they're just being rude. But when you're consciously symbiotic, when they differentiate in your face, it's kind of fun. It's like, oh, so you really are there. You really were awake. So I think it comes out of emotional wounding. Now, emotional wounding has to do with the wounding that we've been talking about in Imago Therapy for years, and that is the child, the infant, not getting needs met. As those needs arise, and appropriately as the developmental stages change and needs change. For instance, the infant, as Leah was born, Hunter was born, the basic need was to maintain contact. The basic need for an infant is not to make contact with the caretaker, but to maintain contact with the caretaker. It's not a symbiotic fusion, it is a relationship to maintain that. Again, the older theory was not only were infants fused with the caretaker in a symbiotic fusion, but one of the first tasks was to become somehow attached to the caretaker beyond that symbiotic fusion. There's some sort of first step that it was attachment. If that failed, then it didn't work. Now what's clearer is that infants are not symbiotic but are attached to the caretaker, and that what the task of the caretaker is not to facilitate attachment, but to facilitate the maintenance of the connection that's already there. So the loss or the failure to get all the needs met then is connected to the production of the emotional wound. Now, here's how the wounding produces symbiosis. The analogy that I use most of the time, because I run out of metaphors, is you're walking on a beach and you stump your toe, or you're running on the beach to the ocean, you stump your toe. What immediately happens is that the beach and the sun and the ocean disappear, and all you have left is a toe. And the toe is hurting, so that it becomes the center of your consciousness. Now that's what we mean by becoming self-absorbed. The moment of pain, you become self-absorbed. And we all do that. It's a natural response. Now, consider this, that if this person running on the beach, stumped their toe over and 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 over again, then eventually there would simply be a toe, a bigger toe, a bigger wound, no beach, no sky, no sand, no warm, no sun, no nothing, just a hurting toe. Hurt over and over again. Well, what would happen then is that the transient self-absorption that comes from a stumped toe, and then when the pain goes away, the beach fades back in, the water fades back in, the sun's back in, and you go off and play. The transient self-absorption changes to chronic self-absorption with chronic repetition of the pain of the stumped toe. Now, move that over into childhood and consider that every infant who is wounded, and most of us as infants are and were wounded, then the wound, that is the deprivation of the need being met at an appropriate time by the appropriate person, is frustrated. If it's frustrated, it's frustrated over and over and over and over and over again, because the parent, the caretaker, is keratologically consistent. The caretaker is constantly redoing the same thing, that is, withholding, not being there, feeling tense, being depressed, whatever makes them in some sense unavailable to the need system of the infant, so that the pain of the infant is experienced regularly and therefore chronically, and therefore self-absorption becomes chronic. And it becomes chronic to the point that there is what has been called, I don't know who discovered the effect, I found it in Herbert Benson's book, The Kindling Effect. Until after a while, there is a a pathway of sensitivity to injury that is so sensitive that even the possibility of such an injury becomes as painful as the injury itself. It's like a wound, a sore, a rising. And so this sensitivity to pain is there. So consequently, when you have that heightened level of sensitivity to pain, your self-absorption is equally as high because now you're chronically on guard in order to prevent yourself from being wounded, which means the absorption level is very high. Now, when you are chronically wounded and therefore chronically self-absorbed, you lose awareness of context. You lose awareness of context. You do not know that the sun is there, the stars are there, the ocean is there. And what happens is that losing awareness of input from the context because of the static that comes from the repetition of the pain and the self-absorption, the messages that come from the outside are distorted. Many of them are blocked. Lots of them are, sometimes they're even feared. But fundamentally, there's not a full awareness of what the outside world is doing, what the context is doing. So the brain, in its need for stimulation, when it blocks the outside world, then amplifies the message from the inside world and amplifies its own messages. The practical outcome of that is that having blocked the outside world because of my self-absorption, I'm now generating the outside world as my, I'm now generating the outside world from my inside world. Or otherwise, I'm externalizing my inside world as the outside world. Therefore, I become symbiotic. I assume that what I'm thinking is what you're thinking. I'm assuming that what's happening in me is what's happening out there. I'm assuming that what I like is what you like. I'm assuming that everybody is hurting, everybody's in pain, everybody's scared, everybody's happy, everybody's joyful, everybody's, you know, loving this speech, whatever, at this point. So at the point that I assume that another subjectivity is similar to mine, I am symbiotic. Any time I assume that another person is thinking, feeling, wishing, hoping, or has had an experience like mine, I'm exhibiting my symbiosis, the failure to differentiate myself from the other. So that symbiosis then becomes a chronic condition. Now, I think that given that, that symbiosis, that is the failure to differentiate self from the other as a subjective separate entity, is the human problem. Because it is that lack of awareness of the other that is the root of contempt, of disrespect, of criticism, confrontation. Now let's take it a little further. War, this tribe, this group, and so forth don't agree with us. They have other standards. They have a different color skin. Whatever. If there's any sense of otherness, any sense of separateness, it has to be canceled out in some way. So in a love relationship, in a marital relationship, if one partner says, gee, I really think that was a great movie. If you don't think it was a great movie, you say, well, how could anybody who was intelligent say something like that? Well, then, of course, you've just been told that to have a thought means that you're stupid, especially that thought. So that differentiation of others from self is canceled out through devaluation. Is this beginning to make any sense to anybody? And I think at this point it's a good idea to ask if you've ever done that to anybody. You've never done that to anybody. You've never said, that was a stupid thought. Or, more kindly, how could you think that? Or, even more kindly, you like that? And what all of that is saying is, your subjectivity doesn't correlate with mine, so there's something wrong with you. Whatever it is that makes you different from me makes you wrong. Because in the symbiotic delusion, the fusion, the delusion of the fusion, the self becomes the center. I become the center of the universe. I become the point by which all other points in the universe are evaluated as having some validity or not. Now, this center, for some reason, becomes prized by us. It becomes so prized that we feel that we are threatened if anyone else suggests an alternative position to the position that we hold, an alternative feeling to the feeling that we hold, an alternative desire. So we have to devalue the subjectivity of another in order to maintain ourselves at the center. And anyone who challenges that center has to be devalued. And that means that in marriages, there are few marriages in which there's room for two people. It means that in most marriages, there's only room for one person. And as you know, in 50% of the marriages, one of those persons, usually the one who cannot establish and maintain the dominance, or the one who fails to maintain the dominance, it can go either way, leaves. And it is often the case that the person who is attempting to establish the dominance is the one who leaves. It's not the one who fails, but the one who attempts to always be at the center. Because always trying to establish dominance and having someone respond back non-symbiotically becomes so threatening that you feel that you have to get rid of the person because they will not disappear as a result of your wishes. So the attempt for the, and so often the person who attempts to dominate the situation is the one who actually splits. It's not, I keep presenting myself and I can't get your attention, because that position usually is pretty addictive. They keep trying at it, but it's the person who keeps trying to control the situation that often leaves. Okay, so we're down to emotional symbiosis in terms of what that is and how that functions. Now, before I shift the slide, I think it's really, it seems really clear to me that this is truly a description of romantic love. That romantic love is, of all forms of human experience, one of the most symbiotic. Because in romantic love, actually, people surrender their boundaries and their subjectivities, and they say, oh, yes, you know, let's wear the same shirt, let's eat the same ice cream, let's, you know, yes, I enjoyed it, I just thought that movie was wonderful, and you thought it was shit, but you won't say so. That is, there is both conscious and unconscious symbiosis, and that the power struggle is a decision at some point not to do that anymore. That the power struggle begins with a challenge to the fusion, to the symbiotic fusion. Is this beginning to make sense?
Yeah.
And so it depends on then how that fusion is negotiated as to whether or not the power struggle will result in a split in the relationship or whether it will result in psychological growth. So I will come back in a few minutes to talk about, given that thesis, how dialogue then becomes not only a good communication device, but an essential interaction between individuals in order to end the symbiosis and to further psychological development. Because psychological development is nothing other than the self differentiating itself until it becomes a self so that it can then make, so that it can then be in contact with others. So it's not that we differentiate to autonomy, but we differentiate through autonomy to relationship. And so dialogue is the only way to further the autonomy and to ultimately establish relationship, given the human condition. So that's the reason for the shift that some of you are familiar with. In imago therapy, dialogue is the process. And that there's no such thing as a lot of imago things, you have to decide when to do them. Dialogue is what you do, and you do that all the time in a variety of different ways. Now what we're clear about is that that particular process is what is essential in order to do what has to be done, which is to help couples finish the developmental stages, to finish growing up, because their limited emotional development, mine and your limited emotional development, is where our problems come from. Not that we have problems, but we are a problem because our character structures in relationship to our woundedness is what produces our problems. And there's nothing you can do about that other than to grow up. That is, to grow out of that and grow into another developmental stage. That's why therapy, real therapy, takes so long, but why growth-facilitating therapy is the therapy, rather than analytical therapy or whatever, why growth-facilitating therapy is so so effective. So let's review this and deepen this a little bit now with some slides, and that is that we have defined symbiosis as the belief that other people share my subjective states. But I have to say that this is not a conscious belief. It is an unconscious assumption that functions as an unconscious belief. Other people share my... Am I cold right now? Are you cold right now? Are you not cold right now? So you have a sort of a low metabolism, right? Yeah, you don't respond very well to cold drafts. So have you had your thyroid checked recently? So if you don't share my subjective state, clearly there's something wrong with you.
It is a little cooler.
It is a little cooler. In fact, one of the ways to establish a pseudo-community is to become consciously symbiotic at the moment. But you can also make people feel really wonderful about you. I've often told the story about helping my wife with a fundraising device, because she's a philanthropist who robs from the rich and gives to the poor. That is, she raises money, and her philanthropy is that. And I go to these meetings where the people are coming to be fed, to be talked to be pitched to, and, you know, and as always, get out your checkbook now before you leave. And I did not want to be there, because I'd been out something like this, where I was gone for 3 or 4 days and I was peopled out, and I just wanted to not function. So I told her that I would be there. I'd promised to be there. It was a part of my behavior change requests, my gift to you, but I'm not going to talk. And so what I decided to do during that time, about a two-hour dinner, was to mirror everybody and just say, you know, so I'm hearing you. So in a sense, I became functional, symbiotic with everybody, and even said, you know, I can see your point. Kind of a pseudo-validation. And at the end of the dinner party, having functioned in that sort of symbiotic confluence for those 2 hours, I was standing with Helen at the door, and these 10 people who were at my table, 9 people at my table, all of them went out the door and said to Helen, "My, what an interesting, look at the word, husband you have. Interesting husband." All I did was mirror them. I said nothing about myself, not a single personal word all evening. And nobody at that time recognized me nor knew that I was a writer. So, and nobody asked me. It's interesting, too, if you're mirroring and really, really flowing with somebody, they don't ask you any questions about you, because they're so full of being filled by your attention that they forget that you're there. And so if you don't want anybody to ask you anything about you, just be really interested in them and say, oh, and if they do try to shift it, just say, but that, you know, I'd really like to hear more about how, you know, that in you and how that question arises and what that, you know, and tell me about that and so forth. And they just glow with that. So I found that anytime I'm exhausted, that I can be really this hit of the party if I function symbiotically with the group that I'm in. I'm not going to do that today. I'm not going to be symbiotic with you. I want to inflict your symbiosis with consciousness, with differentiation. Is that right?
No, not necessary.
It's more fun to be symbiotic. Okay, other people share my subjective states. Now, we found that there are two types of symbiosis. There's a normal symbiosis, and then there's a grandiose symbiosis. And you might check out which one is your favorite. The descriptors of normal symbiosis include sentences like, you think the way I think, don't you? There's always that question. Because somehow we all know people don't, so we ask them if they do, don't you? You know, sort of. And you feel the way I feel, don't you? You feel cold? You feel warm now?
It's getting colder.
Getting colder now. So I can see that your body is changing. You know, or you want what I want, don't you? You want to go to the movie? You want to see a movie about a woman who gets depressed and commits suicide?
My favorite.
That's your favorite kind. Or would you rather see a Pink Panther movie?
No.
What about Lethal Weapon 3?
No.
Well, I really thought you had good taste in movies.
Now you know.
Helen and I have this argument all the time. When she says, let's go to a movie, I say, well, are there going to be two depressed women and they both commit suicide as it's packed, or just one, or is it the daughter or the mother? And it's clearly the case that Helen loves depressive, suicidal, and especially of women committing suicide. I've often asked her, what does this mean about her own dark side and her own, well, clearly unactivated and unexpressed depression that she is, vicariously living it through on the screen. And I always want to go to the Pink Panther movies where something really funny and light and silly happens, or I want to go to Lethal Weapon 3. Where you just get these whole buildings destroyed, you know, and bodies around. And so now she asks, is there something about my hidden aggression? But I think aggression is more fun than depression. And it's always seemed like more fun to me to just watch all that and get that adrenaline going, you know, just get it up there. What is the drug that goes with depression? Does anybody remember that? When your body chemistry changes, what's the dominant drug? Who's the doctor here? One of you psychiatrists. What is it? Lowered. It's lowered. It's a loss of serotonin. Then you get depressed. Okay. So you it's better to have a lot of adrenaline than very little serotonin. Oh, sure. I'll take adrenaline anytime. Feels so powerful. And that's serotonin level goes low, you feel so helpless. What?
I think
agrees with you? You like lowered serotonin better? You know what you want what I want. And you see what I see. It's sort of a five senses kind of thing. You see what I see. Oh, didn't you? Didn't you see that bird? Helen and I went bird watching one time, and I swear we almost got divorced over the fact that she saw a bird and I couldn't see the bird. And she says, you can't see the bird? So I took her binoculars instead of mine. I still couldn't see the bird. So I get into the sense that there is no bird, but then I have to account for why there's a sound, like a bird, coming from the place where the bird is. But Helen's eye, as a bird watcher, has been trained to see birds. And she can pick them out from these green things. And I look up there, and to me it's just a spot on the green. Now, if I'm looking long enough and the bird moves, then I realize that there was something there. But if the bird doesn't, and Helen can look at it and delineate it and so forth. So she has this this thing about that. But you can see how you can get in trouble. And you hear, don't you hear the bird sound? Didn't you hear that? Didn't you agree with that? Isn't that a beautiful song? Oh, God, there's so many couples fight over it. Isn't that a beautiful song? So wonderful. Listen to that melody. Yuck. And your taste buds. Now, this is a really good one. Your taste buds are identical to mine. Don't you like that? Don't you like fried chicken? You do like fried chicken. Yeah, your taste buds are like me. You must have grown up in the South. You're a good old boy. No, where'd you go?
North.
In the North, I didn't know people ate fried chicken in the North.
Boiled
chicken in the North. Say fried. Yucky. Fried chicken. Fried chicken tastes good. So your taste buds are identical to mine. I never could figure out for a long time why Helen didn't like pecan pie. Anybody who's anybody likes pecan pie, right? Yes. I mean, no matter that there's a pound of lard in it and another pound of butter and another pound of sugar and not much else except a little thin crust and a little layer of pecans. Yeah. I was told that one small slice of pecan pie is 600 calories. And that actually that spoiled my experience with that. It also made me wonder, what happened in my childhood when I used to eat one a week? You know, my sister made pecan pies. I would eat a slice a day, be gone in a week. And here I am at this ripe old age, and I've never had a day's illness. Was it bad to eat the stuff or not? I think it's worse to know that it's bad for you than it is to eat it not knowing it's bad for you. Because if you eat it knowing it's bad for you, then your mind says you're killing yourself. But if you eat it and you think it's good for you, your mind says this is a nutrient, and therefore, isn't that what Deepak Chopra says? That the way you think about it is what it becomes? That's good. And so you experience what I experienced. Wasn't that a great orgasm? Yeah. And you like that sexual experience? Wasn't that good?
I didn't know it.
You didn't know you had one?
No.
You know that old question, was it good for you too?
Yes.
Oh, it wasn't? And then you can go into the guilt or accusation. You know, it wasn't. Well, there's something wrong with me, something wrong with you. I liked it. So the descriptors. But the alternate definition of symbiosis is I'm one. I mean, we are one, and I'm the one. And clearly that's the experience of being at the center. So grandiose symbiosis, we found that it can be divided into two parts. Naive grandiose symbiosis and paranoid. And just to give you a definition of those, naive symbiosis is a belief that other people are thinking about you and that they adore you. I like that one. I find that that's a really wonderful way to live. In fact, it even attracts adoration. If you believe other people adore you, sometimes they really do. You kind of expect it. You know, haven't you seen a kid walk into a room just assuming that everybody loved them and everybody did? They loved them because they walked into the room. They were so competent and so confident and so joyous, and it just recreated that. And you've also seen the paranoid symbiosis. People walk into you walk into a room, the kid is frightened, afraid people in there are going to be angry at them, and people don't relate to them. It's like the perception does that. But paranoid symbiosis is the belief that other people are thinking about you, and they are out to get you. This is without checking any facts. Of course, you know symbiosis is fact void. It's a fact void. Now, here are some symbiotic wishes that I've picked up in listening to people. And one is the wish to be in your awareness at all times. This has to do sometimes with one partner who says, do you think about me today while you were working? Did you miss me? Don't you find it more fun to be with me than at work? So forth. So I'm in your awareness at all. Have you ever had anybody put that pressure on you to ask you that question? Am I in your awareness at all? Have you ever had that feeling, you wishing that, you know what that's like? Am I in your awareness? Have you ever had that thought?
Not really.
You've seen other people do that. Yeah. Most of us are exempt from all of the foibles of our couples.
No problem.
Yes, so that's why we can treat them, is that we are superior to them. I'm your one and only, aren't I? And this is another one of the great wishes, that I be the only person in your life. Not only in your awareness,
now, but in your life, totally. So clearly, only in your awareness. Another wish is I know you want me. It's a symbiotic wish, is that to know that you want me, don't you?
Absolutely.
Don't you? Yeah, you want me. Yes. I like that. And we're one. All our stuff is, and you know what I want. You've heard this is, I've labored this many times under the power struggle stuff, is you know what I want, don't you? And how unhappy a partner is to discover that their partner doesn't know what they want. How unhappy they are is that the symbiotic wish is really challenged and broken when the partner says, I don't know what you want. I don't know what you like. The wish to be one, the wish to be in the awareness at all times, the wish to be known, the wish to be experienced. When they guess wrong, that's really bad. It's really bad. To say you don't know is one thing, but then to do something and to do it wrong is a real challenge. And the other part of the symbiotic wish you... That's the one that gets me the most, is that I have this real aversion to ties. People giving me ties, because I only like three kinds of ties. It's the same design, blue, red, and maroon, and with the same little small design on it. It's called the power tie in New York. But, you know, only bankers wear them. But with those three ties, I can wear all of my suits, all of my sport coats, and in fact, don't even have to know which one I'm picking, because those ties will go with all of the suit colors. And so Helen often gives me, you know, a Hermes tie, which has a design on it that's a little off blue and off that. And you have to match a Hermes tie with a Giovanni suit in order for the color tones to fit. But if you take a red tie and put it with a navy blue suit, it always goes right, you know. Or you take a red tie and put it on with a gray suit, it's fine. Or you take a maroon tie and put it on. And the only thing is, you don't want to go into the browns if you've got a maroon tie. But if you stay in the grays, the blues, and the blacks, you're just fine. And it's just simple. There are only three ties on my rack. But actually, there are about 100 ties on my rack. And they were all given to me. And, you know, I take them and hang them up and say, don't ever do this again. And the next year, either one of the kids gives me one, or Helen gives me one, and so forth. And it's like, it was like she's saying to me, I know what you want, I know what you like, I know what you would love. She gave me a tie the other day with a Star Trek symbol on it. Now, I love Star Trek, and I watch Star Trek every time Star Trek comes on, whether it's new, old, rerun, or whatever. But I don't want a Star Trek tie. I want a red tie, or a maroon tie, or a yellow tie with one of those little round diamond sort of things on it. You know, it looks like a cog wheel, you know what I mean? And you can wear it with anything you put on, because I think ties were invented by people who hated men. And clearly, the main haters of men in the human history have been women. And so ties were made by women who wanted men to choke. And so, consequently, we ought to not subscribe to this. It's like women not subscribing to patriarchy anymore. Men should no longer support the hidden desire of women that all men be choked to death by, you know, consciously, symbolically acting it out by putting on ties and wearing them in public. So I'm going to do it mainly when I go on television, mainly when I'm in places where I want to fit into the culture, so that I don't have to be asked, am I straight or not? Or am I, sort of esoteric or not? I want to be a really respected person, and the most respected people in this culture wear maroon ties with little gray dots and gray or black or blue suits. Isn't that right, Yumi?
Absolutely.
And if you get out of that, and some wear beards and can get away with that, but you have to be Jewish to do that. And a little bit more evolved. And I've actually noticed that more Jewish than Protestant men wear beards. Protestant, especially Baptist Protestants, don't wear beards very often, which is strange since they're so in love with the figure of Jesus, who clearly was a beard. Wasn't Jesus bearded? Or did he have a clean face? It depends on which picture you look at. Anyway, we're back to symbiosis. Now, isn't that wonderful? Don't y'all all agree with all of that? Sure.
And we want the same things, don't we? And the real disappointment when we don't want the same things. I often find this is the case around vacations. Oh, you don't want to go to Bali. You don't want to go to the Caribbean. You don't want to go camping. Oh, you don't? And then Helen and I sometimes have it around artistic things. You can imagine that she loves opera and I love plays. Of course, the plays that I love are funny plays, and the operas that she loves are tragic operas. And in fact, one night I took Helen to a play, and it was a surprise play, and she was happy to go. And we parked on 246th Street off Broadway, and one side of the theater was My Fair Lady. The other side was Cyrano de Bergerac. And I looked at Helen's face, and she had just looked out at My Fair Lady, and her countenance just dropped. Because, you know, that's kind of a light musical, very sentimental and warm. But Cyrano, I mean, Cyrano is a tragic comedy. Here's this poor man, you know, in this life. And I got her out of the car and turned her to walk into Cyrano. And she just turned and hugged me. She says, "How did you know? How did you know?" Well, you know, the surprise thing about droppings, random droppings, I'd written it down. And I'd heard her say one time that she can't stand My Fair Lady. And Cyrano is her favorite musical drama. So clearly, you know, we would go to Cyrano. Actually, it was a good production of Cyrano. I enjoyed it for the first of the 15th time that we've seen it. It was actually a good one. But we want the same things. I'm in the wrong line of sight here. Now, here's the tragedy about symbiosis. Is that once you become symbiotic, and most of us do in childhood, the first casualty of the symbiosis is the loss of empathy. Because when you're wounded, you become self-absorbed. And therefore, as that becomes a chronic condition, then you lose your ability to experience the subjectivity of others as existent, much less as something to experience empathically. So the problems in the world, just to move from couples therapy to this, I think clearly are connected to this early wounding, the symbiotic consciousness that arises out of that, and then the loss of the ability to respond empathically to another person's subjectivity. The more symbiotic you are, the less empathic you can be. Now, we've talked for a long time about how do we talk about what's considered to be, we now call them the early wounded couple, because we are tired of the abusive terms, borderline narcissistic couples. But that phenomenon of the person who has been wounded early in childhood, all of you know that when those couples come to your office, that the one thing you don't get out of any of them is an empathic response. That's what you get out is a terror at any differentiation on the part of the other partner. An intense critical response to maintain the symbiosis of the partner. That is, to devalue and deny any thought, feeling, or desire that the partner has. And even when the partner loses their defenses and their pain and hurt come through, as it does sometimes for one of these partners, the thing you don't see is an immediate empathic response to that, indicating that that couple, those two persons, are severely wounded early in life to the extent that they lost the capacity to experience another, and that others serve for them and function for them as symbiotic extensions of themselves. They have to have these symbiotic extensions. And when the extension, which is the other person, differentiates, then the response to that differentiation is usually brutal, either emotionally or physically. And the brutality of it lies in usually a devaluation to the point
that you couldn't possibly think that, believe that, or do that, or want to do that, or want to play golf, or why should you, or why do you want to work so hard? You know, it's just whatever it is that differentiates you from myself, or and my image of you, which is still myself, is an unacceptable thing. So the loss of empathy, I think, is the core human tragedy. Because without empathy, it's impossible to connect. So that what is necessary in order for connection to occur, which is the goal that we all have in Imago Therapy, is a process that enables a person to become, to make contact, a dialogical process. And it is in making contact that you discover the subjectivity of the other as separate from the self. And then once that's discovered, then it's possible to experience the other empathically. That is, to experience their pain. But you can't experience another person's emotionality until you've actually differentiated that there is another other than the self. It's like I think I've told the stories, and you've probably heard it, is that one of the things that was my philosophy professor in college said that in fact has led in the past few years to formulating this as it came back to me was that the basic human problem is the fear of the other. And along with that is the fear that I am not the center. And that desire to be at the center is one of the fundamental aspects of the human trauma. So the emotional wound that leads to symbiosis. And now all of that leads to the power struggle beliefs. As you can now see how this feeds into, therefore, given the human condition of symbiotic fusion, of a loss of empathy, then it makes sense that couples feel that their needs are so important to them that they can inflict injury on their partners to get their partners to meet their needs. And I have no empathy with your discomfort with my needs and with the infliction of my pain on you to get that. You really should be doing that. You really should be feeling this. You really should be wanting that. You really should be responding with that. And if I criticize you, if I hurt you enough, then you will meet my needs. You will love me. and if you try to differentiate from me, of course, then I'll have to inflict enough pain on you to get you to go back to the symbiotic fusion. You can also see now how the second belief arises out of symbiosis, which is that you know what I need and I don't have to tell you. That this is a belief that's connected to symbiotic fusion. And the third belief is that you have what I need, but you won't give it to me. In other words, I know why you withhold things from me. You've got it. I know you've got it. And I know that you're withholding from me. It's not that you're incapable. It's just that you don't want to. And that makes it unacceptable. That makes it indefensible. If you couldn't do it, that'd be one thing. But since you won't do it, that's another thing. So these assumptions that are arise out of the power struggle of omnipresence, the symbiotic, you can now see how symbiosis applies to a lot of religious constructions, is that God exists only for me and I am in the center of God's consciousness. You only exist for me. And you can imagine how that sentiment would arise as a powerful religious sentiment given the universal factor of wounding. That if we're all wounded and disconnected from the caretaker, then it makes sense that we would reconnect in some sense to an abstraction, and that it would have the same characteristics. Omniscience, you know all my needs, arises from the symbiosis, and omnipotence, you have the power to meet all my needs. And you've been through the power struggle stages before, so I won't go back through those. Just wanted to basically establish the theory of symbiosis. Let me just do this briefly, because where we take a break. You can now see how with the symbiotic thesis, all of the stages of the power struggle make sense. Because when you're in love, you're in a symbiotic fusion with your partner. So when your partner expresses some differentiated aspect of themselves, whatever that might be, whether that's negative or positive, if it doesn't fit with the symbiotic
image, then it's a shock. There's somebody else in the world. I'm not the center. I'm not the center. So it's a shock. And then you can't believe it. So you deny that that person did that or that that's true of that person. But once there's a differentiated aspect of another person, it doesn't go away. You can deny it, but it keeps presenting itself because it is, in fact, there. They are so tall. They do smell occasionally. And if they're depressed chronically. And, you know, if they sleep late or whatever it is that, that made them not fit your ideal anymore of who it is you married. So then you go into anger and depression because you cannot reestablish the fusion, the symbiotic fusion. You go into anger and depression. And then movement out of that is into bargaining. Well, why don't you be symbiotic with me today and I'll be symbiotic with you tomorrow. You take out the trash and I'll do this and so forth. And therefore we'll maintain a kind of symbiotic thing. And that doesn't work. Then you go into despair because you can't maintain the fusion, can't maintain the symbiosis. And then the last thing we know is that in order to get out of that, you have to accept the fact that your partner's not you. That there is a differentiated consciousness whom you live with, whom you have not yet discovered. And that we do that through the dialogical process. I'm always out of the line of sight of that. So, to become conscious in your marriage, you have to engage in a dialogical process by which the other person emerges as a self. And I think I'll stop and give you a break right now. My guess is you'd like one sitting there right after lunch.